You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday World News Roundup with a ceasefire in Sudan and an arrest of alleged Chinese secret police in Manhattan. Those stories and more tonight at 6 on 1A+. Now, Dominion Voting Systems settled its defamation lawsuit against Fox News earlier this week, with Fox agreeing to pay $787 million in damage to the voting machine company. The settlement was struck just minutes before a trial was set to begin. Dominion sued Fox over false claims that hosts on the network made about voting machine fraud during the 2020 election. Court filings during the case showed that Fox executives and hosts doubted some of the claims they were making on air. The network acknowledged false claims in a statement but won't have to apologize on air. Here's a listen to Dominion attorney Justin Nelson after the settlement.
This litigation cannot solve all problems. All of us remain ever vigilant to find common factual ground. Today represents a ringing endorsement for truth and for democracy.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this settlement between Fox News and Dominion? Are you disappointed it didn't make it to the trial? What would you have wanted to learn more about? What questions do you have about the media laws involved and what can happen when a news outlet makes false claims? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ronell Anderson-Jones is a professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. She specializes in the relationship between media and the courts, press access, and defamation cases. She's also a former newspaper reporter and editor. Ronell, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is this case comparable to much else we've seen in the courts when it comes to media defamation lawsuits?
No, this case is something of a unicorn. The constitutional bar in these kinds of cases involving public figures and matters of public concern is set incredibly high. So these are very difficult cases to bring. And because of that, they don't get brought very often. And when they are brought, they virtually always settle at a much earlier stage than this. So this is the rare case that proceeded all the way to the very cusp of trial. And it's rare in that the public got to see in filings in the court this fairly rich trove of evidence that Dominion said that it could use to show that high constitutional standard of knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth.
I want to talk about that bar, that standard, a little more. It's not just a media outlet made a mistake, or even that the mistake they made was disparaging in some way about the person suing. What more needs to be established to even get a case like this into a courtroom in the first place?
That's right. The United States Supreme Court has said that because we want to have a broad scope of freedom for press speakers and those who are commenting on matters of public concern, it isn't enough in these kinds of cases to show that the media outlet was sloppy or that it was negligent or that it was biased or even that it was inaccurate. You have to show what the court called actual malice. It's sort of a poor term for the actual concept. It doesn't mean malice in the sense of anger or bad feelings, but rather is about the news outlet's relationship with the truth. It's about what they knew. It's a state of mind standard. But you have to climb inside those shoes and demonstrate to the jury by clear and convincing evidence that the media entity knew or recklessly disregarded the falsity that it ultimately broadcasted. And it's quite difficult, and deliberately so. The court said, we don't want it to be easy for people to weaponize defamation law against those who are commenting on matters of public concern. And so we set the standard very high and make it possible for there to be quite a lot of falsehood that still circulates in the press and gets countered in other ways, only in these rare instances of a sort of knowing, conscious lie that harms reputation can recovery happen.
Before we dig into Fox, one more point of contrast here. Sarah Palin, former Alaska governor, former vice presidential candidate, had filed a libel suit against the New York Times. A column had gotten something wrong about her. It did not paint her in a flattering light. it did not make it to anywhere near this stage of court. What was going on there that made that fall short of that bar?
Yeah, that case happened last year. It was between Palin and the New York Times, and it was different, I guess, in two important ways. One important way was that it involved a single statement, one sentence that was erroneous and harmful to Palin's reputation in a single publication in the New York Times. The Dominion suit was more about a pattern and practice. There were 20 total suits, 19 of which Dominion said were broadcasted on Fox after Dominion had alerted Fox to the falsity of these wild allegations and had pointed Fox and its hosts in the direction of accurate information. So in terms of scope and scale, this was a much different kind of suit. And then the second way that it was different was in terms of the proof of evidence of knowing falsity. In the Sarah Palin suit, Palin's camp attempted to demonstrate that the New York Times ought to have had a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity of the statement that was made there, connecting Palin's campaign erroneously to a shooting that had occurred. But it was a much more distant and tangential evidence in comparison to the Dominion suit, where Dominion had gathered through discovery a large body of internal evidence of actual text messages and memos within Fox saying things like, this is a lie, this is ludicrous, this is crazy, pointing to what Dominion said was proof not just of a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity, but actual knowledge of falsity on the part of Fox and its hosts.
Talking to Ronell Anderson-Jones from University of Utah's College of Law, looking at the Fox News settlement with the voting company, voting machine company, Dominion. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. Believe it or not, I was one of those people who was kind of hoping to see this thing go to trial. And that's in part because I was hoping more details would come out. I also think that while Fox is paying out money to a company that it caused harm to, there's a value that we might miss to a degree of basically at the end of the court case, Fox News potentially being required to say to its viewers, hey, we lied to you about this big thing. And with them not being able to require it, they might hope to sweep this under the rug in a year or two. And I'm curious just how dishonest Fox News or other organizations might be, because this is one of those few times where we as outsiders actually get to see some of the internal thoughts in that organization.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. Ronell, Nate brings up a couple of big points there. First, he's disappointed. He was hoping we would learn more with a lot of key Fox personalities on the stands, I think, in a trial. What do we not get because of this settlement?
Yes, well, your caller is expressing a frustration that I think was commonplace, and that actually points to a wider point that this case has helped us see as sort of as a nation and as a people. Defamation law might be one tool that we think of as useful in the wider fight against broader societal disinformation, but it's in many respects a limited tool. Here, Dominion was only able to sue about the lies that were told about Dominion, very specific defamatory lies that harmed the reputation of this particular company. And it all happens in this framework that is motivated by civil litigation between these two corporations, which means that eventually when the settlement number gets high enough here, upwards of $750 million, the folks who hold financial interests in those companies really have very little choice but to move forward and make decisions that are better than rolling the dice and moving before a jury, no matter how confident you might feel in your claim. And so the desire that a lot of folks have to play out sort of and litigate in the public sphere wider questions of election denialism and disinformation more broadly are sometimes disappointed, right, in the limitations that defamation law has. The caller is also definitely correct that we would have gotten more detail had we moved forward to trial. Scheduled on the witness list were a number of key players at Fox, including some of the biggest named hosts and Rupert Murdoch, who sits atop the Fox Corporation structure. And so a lot of this story would have been played out of the mouths of key Fox players themselves. That said, Dominion did delay this settlement until truly the 11th hour. I mean, the 11th hour and the 59th minute. The jury was impaneled. Oral arguments were about to begin. And because this didn't settle earlier, I mean, if this had settled, for example, in February, before the trove of evidence that was gathered in the case had been made public, these kinds of conversations that we're having in amongst the citizenry wouldn't have been able to take place. And you can imagine Fox would have been quite incentivized to have settled prior to the revelation of all of this evidence about what people internally there said about Donald Trump, what people there said about their own sources, what they said about their own audience. And Dominion presumably refused to settle at that stage, moving to a place in which more of that information made its way into the public sphere and could spur the kinds of conversations that we're having now.
And Nate also brings up the point that Dominion had been hoping for an apology, an admission of guilt, maybe even an on-air to their own viewers admission of being wrong here. That doesn't appear to be part of this settlement. What do you make of that, Ronell?
Yes, I can only expect that Dominion sought for that component of the settlement and that Fox drew a hard line in the sand in refusing to do it. Fox didn't acknowledge knowing falsity. In fact, Fox didn't even acknowledge falsity. Fox acknowledged that the court acknowledged falsity. That's the extent of the statement that Fox recognized that the judge had held in pretrial motions, in response to pretrial motions, that these statements, some of these statements about Dominion were not accurate. And the fact that that's the most that Dominion could get out of Fox and the desire that Fox has to continue to hold on to maybe some of that audience base that might be craving the sort of ongoing delivery of some of this election denialism is itself maybe problematic. The core centerpiece of Dominion's whole suit is that Fox finds itself between a rock and a hard place on these questions of feeling a lot of pressure from Trump-supporting viewers who threaten to gravitate to other news outlets in the right-wing ecosystem that will deliver up more of this conspiratorial coverage of election denialism. And maybe some of those same pressures continue to exist to this day, which tells us an awful lot about both the problems that we have with the supply of disinformation, but also maybe the seemingly bottomless demand for it.
We're talking to Ronell Anderson-Jones, professor of law at the University of Utah, expert on media and the courts. We're looking at this week's $787 million settlement in a defamation case in which Dominion Voting Systems challenged Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about this case ending up in this settlement? What would you have wanted to see from a courtroom trial? What question do you have about how all of this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ronell Anderson-Jones, media law expert and law professor at the University of Utah, breaking down this week's settlement between Fox News and Dominion Voting Systems, a case stemming from Fox's false claims about Dominion's voting machines after the 2020 election. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this case ending in a settlement? Do you think that's enough accountability for Fox? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ronell, this was a big lawsuit. It's not the only lawsuit. Another voting machine company, Smartmatic, also suing Fox. Dominion also suing some of those other news outlets you mentioned. I believe Newsmax and the OAN One America News. What are you watching for and some of the other legal challenges still out there?
Yes, Dominion was sort of first in line here, the first to get out into the court system and get and move to a jury stage and then to a settlement stage. But there are definitely a number of other suits in the queue. The Smartmatic suit is the one that most of us are watching most closely, both because it is the largest. Smartmatic is another voting machine company. It's seeking $2.7 billion, so even more than was sought in the Dominion case. We're also watching it closely because it deeply parallels the Dominion suit in a lot of really important ways. Smartmatic's claim rises and falls on a lot of the same cast of characters, the same sets of key people, key hosts at Fox, Maria Bartiromo, Lou Dobbs, Jeanine Perot, all of those programs were involved in the Dominion suit and are also involved in the Smartmatic one. And the sources are also overlapping. So people like Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, who were espousing these false statements about Dominion, are also at the center of the Smartmatic case. The case is a little bit different, in part because of the role that Dominion and Smartmatic played in the 2020 election. Dominion is a much larger voting machine company in terms of its role in that particular election. It was involved in more polling places across the country. Fox was sort of arguing that it was it was important and newsworthy that it have conversations about Dominion because of its role in gathering ballots at that time. Smartmatic has, in many respects, a much stronger sort of David and Goliath kind of argument to make here. Smartmatic was falsely accused, it says, of being involved in rigging the 2020 election, but it in fact had a very limited and quite uncontroversial role in the election at all. It was only used in one county in the whole country in that election. And so suggests that it was just sort of wholly invented as a villain to advance this conspiracy theory. And that might explain part of the reason why the damages that are sought are so much larger. So a lot of us will be watching really closely to see how the Smartmatic legal team builds upon what's already been revealed in the Dominion one, takes advantage of some of that body of evidence to try to make its case.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Waupaca. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm a criminal defense attorney. If I were defending Fox, I would say, well, one of the elements is malice, and it wasn't really motivated by malice. It was motivated by profit motive and greed. I mean, Fox News didn't really have anything against Dominion. It's just they wanted to tell their viewers what they wanted to hear to preserve their viewership. And so, yeah, they knowingly lied, but it wasn't out of malice. It was just out of we're trying to keep our audience happy and continue to make profits.
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Ronell, you said in this context, malice isn't just sort of mustache twirling deviousness. Would profit fit that category here?
Yeah, it's a very poor choice of words on the part of the Supreme Court. I've sort of long said this and faced this frustration as a law professor trying to teach the concept to my students who are accustomed to thinking about malice in the criminal context that your caller just referenced. We just use it in a really different way here in the First Amendment space. It doesn't go to the feelings that the speaker had about the subject of the lie. It just goes to their attitude towards the truth. If they engaged in the lie knowingly, or if they showed reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the statement, that counts as actual malice. And whether they were motivated by profit share or to win back audiences or by hatred or by any other motivation isn't particularly pertinent in the First Amendment context. We label it actual malice, but what we care about really is the question of the knowledge of falsity.
Time for one more quick call. Pat is with us in Milwaukee. Pat, hi.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call.
A month ago, I said they're probably going to settle because overall, whether Murdoch's wise enough or proud, too proud to not want to say what he thought, his attorneys finally convinced them to settle because it would be a year long of advertisement about how poorly they're run. But I was surprised that I would think the prosecuting side would say, hey, you want to miss a year of bad PR. Not only are you going to not pay the price you're asking, but you're going to pay a premium. So it's kind of, I'm not a lawyer, so I know the workings are more serious numbers, but I thought they'd actually pay more than the settlement.
Gotcha, Pat. We're just about out of time. Ronell, your thoughts on they kind of split the difference in the overall settlement amount in just our last minute or so.
Yes, I think that's right. It is exceedingly rare for a settlement to be for the asking price at the beginning stage, the amount of damages that were sought at the trial, and would be almost unheard of for the settlement number to be higher than that amount. This number is pretty high, and we think, although these settlements are not often made public, we think it may well be the highest number at which a defamation suit is settled in the history of defamation suits in America. But I agree that lots of folks expected that maybe Dominion held had a lot of cards in its hand at the final moment. It does seem clear that Fox would have been motivated to come to the table in order to avoid a longer, more drawn out, attention grabbing trial that was to come. Juries are just unpredictable, so both parties probably had a pretty significant incentive by the end not to roll the dice and go before one.
Ronell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Ronell Anderson-Jones, professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, also a former newspaper reporter and editor, with us for a look at the settlement in the Fox News Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the U.S. saw a string of shootings last week where people fired at people who mistakenly entered their property without presenting an obvious threat. UW law professor looks at those cases. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, our guest argues that some movies are just better than the books they're based on. We'll get some recommendations. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're cooking with fruit. Meet the author of a new cookbook that celebrates fruit here in the Midwest. First, any bookworm might tell you that the book is always better than the movie. How could a film ever capture all the nuance and detail you get on the page? Well, our next guest, who reads and writes about books for a living, says that some movies just outshine the books that they're based on. We're talking about movies and TV shows adapted from books, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like to read the book first before you see its film or TV version, or do you go back and read a book after you've seen it as a movie or TV show? And what are some of your favorite movies and TV shows based on books? Are there ones you wish would be turned into a movie? Are there ones you've regretted the movie version of? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Olivia Rutigliano is the associate editor of the Crime Reads section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. She's also a PhD candidate in entertainment history at Columbia University. Olivia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. There's a lot of challenges that go from taking a book, especially a beloved book, and turning it into a movie. What are some of the pitfalls that a really good adaptation can avoid?
This is a great question. I think we've been struggling to answer that for many decades. I think the first thing is to weigh the question of narrative fidelity. How important is it to include every minute detail, or is it more important to derive elements from the essence of the work on the whole and transform it into something new? I think a good adaptation often walks the balance between the two, while understanding that a new medium like film or TV is not going to be able to do everything that the original book or source material does and work within those boundaries.
In a recent feature at LitHub, you shared some of your personal favorites. I want to give a listen to one. I mean, a lot of people think of this as one of the best movies of all time. Here's a taste.
Now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me Godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder.
All right, great movie. And you say a much, much better movie than the book. How so?
Well, I think The Godfather, the book, which is written by Mario Puzo in 1969, it's a great book. It introduces us to the Corleone family, and we will always be grateful to Puzo for doing that. But I think the screenplay of The Godfather actually provides an edit of the book that gets us a more economical and very charged version. And Mario Puzo co-wrote the screenplay, which he based off the book, but he co-wrote it with Coppola, who had his own thoughts about how to mold it into a movie. And the two of them edited the original source text together. And that's why I think it works well. It has the true essence of the book through the author's involvement, but it also has a sense of where to cut and where not to cut from an outsider's perspective.
Now, I got to admit, I've never directly read the book, but I double-checked the story with my mom. She was reading The Godfather when she went into labor with me.
Oh my God.
So I figure I must, like, I like cannolis, but I think that's all I've taken away from it. So is it, if I like the movie, do you think it's worth it for me to go back and actually read the book myself?
This is a good question. I mean, I always think it's worth to read the book, if only because it enriches the experience of watching the movie to know what was included and what wasn't. I have a similar thoughts about Jaws, which I think is a much better movie than it is a book. I apologize to Peter eventually. but I always think that reading the book can't do you wrong.
All right, here's a little listen to Jaws, because that was another one you talked about in your piece.
Yes.
Shark! The shark!
Michael's in the pond.
All right, a little taste of the ominous music there. Now, if I'm not mistaken, once again, the author, Peter Benchley, was involved in writing the screenplay?
Yes, he was. Peter Benchley co-wrote the screenplay for Jaws with Carl Gottlieb. And I mean, the thing about the book Jaws is that it tries to do so much, and I don't necessarily think it pulls off everything. But the movie was whittled down to a really fantastic three-act structure. There's clear character development, and a lot of the murky stuff that the characters deal with or are imbued in those characters in the book go away. Like, In the book, Matt Hooper has an affair. Matt Hooper's the character played by Richard Dreyfuss. He has an affair with Chief Brody's wife, and he's actually not a great guy. I mean, I won't tell you what happens to him at the end, but I mean, he is governed by hubris so much. And paring that down and having him be Richard Dreyfuss's sort of nerdy scientist who's able to advocate for the shark without getting in the way of Chief Brody's personal life and impeding Brody's own arc is, I think, a very smart way to trim that character down.
We're talking about book to movie adaptations or book to TV. Olivia Rutigliano is with us. She's written about this and many other topics. You can find her work at LitHub, and she's a PhD candidate in entertainment history at Columbia University. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite book to movie or TV show adaptation where they think they got it right, maybe even better than the book? Or was there one that you were excited about and it let you down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Olivia, here's one you recently wrote about, a long-awaited adaptation of a Judy Blume book, the classic Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. A half-century wait for it to be turned into a movie. What was it worth it? Was it worth the wait?
Oh, it was. It was wonderful. I just saw it a few days ago, so I'm really able to talk about it. It's fresh in my mind. Yes, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was written in 1970. It's about a young girl, an 11-year-old, who moves from New York City to New Jersey, and in her new school has a new group of friends who are very worried about growing up or if they're growing up enough. And a lot of the book is about Margaret's own experiences, understanding herself, understanding her body, her body's changes, but also her relationship to her parents and religion and God, and most dramatically. And these are very, very weighty themes, especially for a book that's aimed at preteens. And so Judy Blume did not sell the rights for 49 years until she found the right people she felt would adapt it with respect and make a progressive, thoughtful adaptation out of it. And she found the right people in Kelly Freeman Craig and James L. Brooks, who made the new movie. And it manages to keep the reverent, respectful, but also funny, curious tone of the book without sacrificing any of the important themes or the really useful work that it does in representing girlhood and all of the things that go along with it.
Okay, now, I mean, I grew up reading Judy Blume. This is a cherished memory, those books, for a lot of kids. Were you nervous about a movie having a go at this one, even with the Judy Blume seal of approval on it?
Oh, I was so nervous. My gosh. Every time a childhood adaptation gets turned into something, I freak out. I was also nervous about last year's Catherine Called Birdie, which is actually a very similar book, very similar movie. It's also about a preteen girl coming to terms with things, especially about her own status and her body, etc. But that takes place in the Middle Ages, and Lena Dunham adapted that one. Just like when I showed up to the movie theater to see Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I was almost shivering. I was so nervous. But this one turned out to be really wonderful. And one of the ways that it was wonderful was that it wisely understood that not only children were going to watch this movie, the book might have its main audience in 11-year-olds, but the movie is going to be seen by a lot of people, including their parents, who take them to it, or older siblings, younger siblings. So this one actually had wide multi-generational appeal, and it cultivated that by expanding the plot to include a lot of detail about Margaret's mom, who was played by Rachel McAdams. So the two actually become parallel figures in this movie, and it's a really nice way to modernize it and update it, but also cater to an audience who might be moms, preteens, somewhere in between or elsewhere on the spectrum.
We have many callers. Let's bring on Don in Union Center. Don, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just, I think in general, a lot of the time, the book is better than the movie. But and one quick example is I'm originally from Trenton, New Jersey, and I really got a laugh out of the Janet Ivanovich Stephanie Plum books. And I never saw the movie, but I heard that was a dog. But as far as movies better than books, I've always liked Dr. Zhivago, and then I read the book, and I thought the book was way too much stuff. The movie was a lot more streamlined, a lot more focused. Just the book was real complicated, if you want to say. So anyway, that's just the biggest example in my mind. Dr. Zhivago, I thought, was a lot better than the book.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Don. And that's kind of the same premise, Olivia, you were talking about with The Godfather. It takes, maybe it streamlined it from the book to the movie.
Yes, I think so. Although Dr. Zhivago might actually be longer than The Godfather. So, and having never read the book, Dr. Zhivago, I wonder how long that must be, actually. But yes, I think that's very similar.
Thanks a lot for that recommendation. We're talking about movies and TV shows that are better than the books they're based on. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, associate editor of the Crime Read section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there any movie or TV adaptations you think did a terrible job of representing the books they're based on, or ones that got it right, maybe even better than the book? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about movies and maybe TV shows that are better than the books they're based on. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, associate editor of the Crime Reads section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. You can join in with your suggestions or anti-suggestions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, a book that I wouldn't consider a great book, but it was a very pleasurable read, was Where the Crawdads Sing by Della Owens. And I thought the movie version enhanced the book. I thought the two just should be one read and the other watched.
And what was it about the movie that you liked even better than the book?
It fleshed out some of the characters that the book kind of left a little bit more. I don't know what the word I'm thinking of is.
Just sort of background characters, maybe.
Yeah.
Interesting. Barbara, thanks a lot for sharing that. That's interesting, Olivia, because in this case, you know, a couple we talked about, Godfather, Dr. Zhivago, our caller thought, hey, it took out some extraneous stuff. It streamlined it. Sometimes people are liking movies better because it fleshed out some of the stuff that was left unexplored in the book.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I mean, do you think that's a common approach?
That's a very good question. I definitely think that sometimes when we read a book, we want more from it. A wise adaptation might give us a lot more to work with. I think one of those examples might actually be William Goldman's The Princess Bride, a book which is excellent, but a movie that knowingly expands certain elements while also maintaining pretty tight textual fidelity. I think sometimes one of the issues is knowing when to stop adding things. When we're turning books into miniseries, how many seasons should we play with? How many seasons should we add on if the first one is successful? Questions like that, I think, should govern these conversations. Sometimes less is more.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to give a listen to another movie you wrote about. This is a clip from Tim Burton's 2003 film, Big Fish.
They say when you meet the love of your life, time stops. And that's true. What they don't tell you is that once time starts again, it moves extra fast to catch up.
Sounds like a Tim Burton film. It's based on the novel by Daniel Wallace. The novel, I guess, is a tribute and reaction to The Odyssey and James Joyce's Ulysses. What is it about that one that made the movie better than the book to you?
Well, Daniel Wallace's Big Fish is a great book. It's a novel about a man's relationship with his father, and it is wonderful. However, I saw the movie first, I will admit, and I was so enchanted by Tim Burton's particularly surreal realization of that. Tim Burton is suited really well, I think, to movies that have a hint of realism, but tip, you know, into fantasy or wild adventures. Not too much. I don't want to be taken away to a fantasy world by Tim Burton entirely, but I want the real world to be injected with something magical by Tim Burton. And it's like a picaresque story. It's about this young man getting to know his father through a lifetime of his father's stories. So the flashbacks that take us to these many adventures as they're narrated by the character of the father, who is played by Albert Finney in the present day and who's played by Ewan McGregor in flashbacks, get to be visually full of the kind of possible exaggeration that, you know, all the really good storytellers we know inject into their stories. So the way that the film is handled visually and sonically pairs really well with the figure of a larger than life raconteur or narrator storyteller who regales us and who you wonder might not be telling the truth, but you don't care. So I thought the visual way Tim Burton was able to navigate that was really masterful. That's what made it special.
We've got some more recommendations from our listeners at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jerry in West Bend. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell you, Rob and Olivia, that this is a wonderful idea for a program. I have been a voracious reader for my lifetime. And one of the books I read was Papillon, The Butterfly. And I read it probably 20 or 30 years ago. And a few years later, I came across the book, and I was very disappointed.
Across the movie, you mean?
I came across the movie.
Okay.
I went to see the movie because I had been I had enjoyed the book so much. And it turned out that what they did is, in the movie, they had the main character have events that happened to four or five different people in the book.
Oh.
All happened. Main character.
Jerry, thanks a lot for that story. Have you had that experience, Olivia, with, you know, that movie you're anticipating from a book you liked, and there was some kind of decision like that just ruined it for you?
You know, one thing that I'm thinking about is actually the new Great Expectations series that aired on FX/Hulu. The Great Expectations is a novel I absolutely love, and I've reread many times over the years. I'm a big Dickens fan. And that adaptation was startling. It was startling how much was moved around, condensed, and straight up invented to the point where I didn't recognize it anymore.
Wow.
So I wouldn't say it's the exact same thing of having multiple characters condensed into one, but it did condense, let's say, 300 years worth of action adventure into the experiences of a single character who often doesn't deal with many of those things in the book. So I was a bit unmoored, let's say, by that decision.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jerry. We're talking about book to movie or book to TV adaptations. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, and we're looking at the ones where the movie did it better or maybe the book did. Back to your calls with Susie in Williams Bay. Hi, Susie.
Yeah, I'm going to say To Kill a Mockingbird.
Are you saying movie better than book?
I think they're both great.
Oh, okay. Oh, that was the one where you liked the book and the movie didn't let you down.
Right. I haven't read the book since high school, and I have seen the movie lots of times on DVD, and I think they're both excellent.
Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that one. Olivia, she likes them both, though it's been a while in the book. Is that one a movie you want to weigh in on?
Yeah, I think those are actually frequently referenced in conversations, articles, where the book is just as good as the movie is just as good as the book. They're both masterpieces. And of course, you know, Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch is one of the most indelible figures in cinema history. An actor, Harper Lee, initially didn't want to play Atticus Finch because she thought he was too dashing, too handsome, and it took some convincing, allegedly. So sometimes even the author is a bit dubious about some of the ways that a text will be realized in real life. But I agree. I think the book and the film both are extraordinarily impressive and very effective in what they set out to do.
Thanks a lot for that call. Maurice joins us now in Madison. Maurice, hi.
How you doing? So my movie is On the Beach with Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner and Fred Astaire in a dramatic role. It's about the surviving people after a nuclear war, and the only people left are in Australia, and they're dying off, too. I didn't read the book, but my point is that it's like comparing apples and oranges because it's a different experience. The emotion that was brought by those characters, I don't think the book could have done that. I remember the author's name is Neville Shute.
Neville Shute, yeah.
And I guess it's a good book. I'll have to read it finally.
Maurice, thanks a lot. I got you. Thanks a lot for the call. I've read the book. It was a great book. Really bummed me out. I didn't want to live through that experience again, honestly.
Yeah.
Olivia, you were nodding along. I think I heard on some of what Maurice had to say, though, on the apples and oranges there.
Yeah, I think they're extremely different. I think the book, On the Beach is a post-apocalyptic movie from the late 50s. And I think in the novel, there's the war starts without any nation being at fault. I think it's more about the destruction of the world and the survivors as opposed to a specific global conflict. And I think that differs than in the book. I think it differs than in the movie. I think the movie is very much about the global politics that lead up to the war and the destruction of the world.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for that call. Olivia, I was just thinking you mentioned authors who don't like where the movie is going. I visited Anne Rice's grave in New Orleans earlier this year. She famously hated the idea of Tom Cruise playing her main character and then took out a full page Variety ad saying, "I love Tom Cruise as my main character." thoughts on that one as we wrap up?
Yes, I think that's one of the famous conversion stories of an author initially not liking the character and then going to like it. I mean, when you write a book and you see someone else realize it, you can have many different reactions. I think Emily St. John Mandel, the writer, has said that she believes other people might actually have better versions of her story than she does.
Wow.
But that's not necessarily shared by every author. And sometimes when you put your heart and soul into a book, you create a character who is, you know, so captivating. It's very hard to see someone you didn't initially envision in that adaptation. I don't know. I know in, you know, one of the great adaptations is Field of Dreams, which is not on the list and which is, I forgot to include when we were doing our roundup. I didn't think of it and I should have, but W.P. Kinsella, the author of the book Shoeless Joe, on which Field of Dreams is based, actually based the character of Ray Kinsella on himself. I mean, how does an adaptation process work when someone's doing it when the character is based on you?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Olivia Rutigliano. We've been talking about films and TV shows adapted from books. Food Friday is up next with Fruit. This is Central Time.